Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Heldon. Well, the 2012 general election is history, and it will soon be time to gavel the Kentucky General Assembly to order. Kentucky Public Radio Frankfort Bureau Chief Kenny Colston is here to talk about the new legislature, including a Kentucky Senate with no David Williams. Hi, Kenny. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, give us a rundown of the House and Senate makeup in Frankfort now post-election.
What we have right at this instant is the Republicans have picked up 4 seats in the House. That makes it 55-45. There are still a few things, re-canvass in a race or two that could flip. One race as was only won by a Democrat by 5 votes. You also have an outstanding lawsuit against Representative Dennis Horlander. So the highest I think Republicans could probably get would be 7 if those two things broke their way. But I mean, well, 6 or 7, depending on how these races. But that's if everything breaks their way. They're probably going to have 4, possibly 5 with this Horlander lawsuit. And the state Senate, they actually gained a seat. The Republicans did. But that race is kind of being contested. They want to re-canvass to relook over those vote totals in that race as well. But that's a little bit bigger margin. I think that's closer to 300 votes. That's probably likely to stand. So the GOP will actually have increased their numbers once again in an election in the state Senate.
So this will be the first session in many years without David Williams, the longtime Senate president. First of all, will there be a special election for his seat?
There will be. It will be on Tuesday, December 18th, to make sure that they actually have a representative. Governor Beshear set that date this week and said that he wanted to make sure that that Senate district had a representative in this upcoming session. Even though it's not a budget session, he says it's still important. There have been 2 Republicans who have gone ahead and said that they want the party nomination, because in a special election, it's not a free-for-all. Basically, the 2 parties, Republicans and Democrats, pick 1 nominee, and then those 2 fight each other out. The Republicans have basically State Representative Sarah Beth Gregory, who is just was elected to her 2nd term in the state House, has said she's interested. And then a lawyer from Albany, which is Albany, Kentucky, which is in the district, has said that he would like the nomination as well. The difference between the 2, besides obviously name recognition and stature, is that this lawyer has said that he will not run for re-election in 2014, and he won't get in the way of redistricting. Basically, the 16th district that Williams represents, it is kind of at the core of redistricting in the state Senate. They own so many seats that it's kind of hard for them not to run against put some of their members against each other. They were able to do so this last time, this last map that got thrown out, because a Republican decided to retire and David Williams was basically going to consume his district. Now that Williams and this lawmaker has retired, you have someone who won in the 15th district. You have an open seat in the Senate, or 16th, excuse me. The thought was maybe, you know, it would just flip the other way. But I think if Representative Gregory is the nominee for the Republicans, and she's likely to win based on the makeup of those counties, you might have an issue. She might say, listen, I don't want to be consumed by this other district. It might be an incumbent versus an incumbent fight down the road.
Now, David Williams no longer a member of the Senate because he was appointed to a judgeship by Governor Steve Beshear. Who's positioning now to run for the Senate presidency?
Well, I think something that we've talked about that a few weeks ago, Robert Stivers is probably the leader in the clubhouse for this, almost a successor. But that being said, independent Bob Leeper has come forward and said, I would like to run it as well. Leeper caucuses with the Republicans to help give them, you know, a supermajority in that chamber. And I think he's kind of seen as a kind of let's transition away from David Williams more so than what Stivers could. Stivers was the majority leader, and while he says he will be different than David Williams, he was still kind of part of that regime. Leeper is the Senate budget chairman. I think he would be a fresh face, used to be a Democrat, then turned Republican, then turned independent. And so I think he's kind of got an outside candidacy. But Stivers says, you know, he's not sure that his caucus is ready to put an independent in control of the entire chamber. That's a little risky. But Leeper could garner some votes.
When will they have the election? And during the organizational session in January?
Yeah, they go for like 1 week in January, then they take a break. That's when they will officially pick. But what the Republicans have done the last couple of times is they take a caucus retreat in December, usually go to like a state park or something like that, hole up for a few days, and that's where they really pick their leaders. That's where they kind of do their leadership election. And then once they get there in January, it's kind of a foregone conclusion because they have so many members that whoever they vote for will get it. So I think we'll know by middle of December who the next Senate president is.
All right, enough of that. Let's talk about Ashley Judd. Now, the word got out this week. It's been spreading like a wildfire that the Kentucky native and actress Ashley Judd might run for the U.S. Senate seat now held by Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who is, of course, seeking re-election. You've been looking into it. What have you heard?
Yeah, actually, I thought you were just talking, maybe she had a new movie out.
Well,
but apparently, she's since I'm here, we've got to talk about politics. Yeah, she has expressed some interest, apparently, in this race. She's expressed it to Congressman John Yarmuth, who said that he thought that would be a power matchup, if that is the case, in 2014. And it appears that she is kind of feeling things out. Now, she is a Tennessee resident, so she would have to buy a house or something and maintain residency for, I think, a year before that election. So she's got some time to do that. But Yarmuth basically says she could raise a lot of money. She's got a lot of ties to the Commonwealth. And it appears that, you know, a U.S. Senate race is probably in her future. Now, whether that's Kentucky or Tennessee, I don't think that decision has been made. But it's definitely out there now. You even have Us Weekly, which is an entertainment tabloid, weighing in on the Mitch McConnell-Ashley Judd race. So I think there are some legs to it, but I don't know that the wheels are totally in motion yet. I think she's just checking out which bus to buy.
This kind of came out of nowhere to casual observers, but she's a longtime activist dating back to her days as a UK student, of course, a Kentucky native. But the big question is, could she beat McConnell, who has raised, what, $7 million now for his reelection bid?
Yeah, the question is, McConnell's going to raise money. We've seen that in all of his reelections. And I think Ashley Judd could be able to raise money from a national profile, being an actress, her connections in Hollywood. That would help her, obviously. There's a contrast of her being a young woman compared to McConnell. And the question really is will some of the stances she's taken, she was a big President Barack Obama supporter, will that hurt her 2 years from now? She was a DNC delegate to the convention this year, so she's really tied into the national party. That will be something McConnell will try to exploit. And then also, she's been very vocal in being anti-mountaintop removal mining, and that's a big issue in eastern Kentucky. That is one issue that can actually kill some Democratic votes for her out in Democratic areas in eastern Kentucky. We saw that happen to Ben Chandler, I think, this week when you go anti-coal. That would probably be her biggest hurdle if she ran against Mitch McConnell.
We will be keeping an eye on this one. Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we now turn to WFPL's Devin Katayama as the testimony phase of Barbara Shanklin's ethics hearing has ended. The Louisville Metro Councilwoman's accused of several violations of the city's ethics code related to taxpayer-funded programs she created that allegedly benefited some of her relatives. Devin's been covering the proceedings, and good to have you back, Devin.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's go back and with a little history of the proceedings. This started with some articles that appeared in the Courier Journal, right?
Yeah, Courier Journal earlier this year, they reported that there was essentially $175,000 that over a 7-year period that went to the Petersburg-Newburgh Association. What the newspaper found was that about 80% of the checks that were being signed by that organization were actually signed by Shanklin. And, of course, this spawned the whole case and the whole common cause of Kentucky's complaint that was filed against Shanklin. And that's what we heard this week was the ethics hearing. It was over a 3-day period that we heard testimony from various Metro Council or Metro Corrections and Louisville Metro government employees about whether this was in violation of the city's ethics code.
And someone has filed an ethics complaint. That's what generated all this. Now, there has been this hearing. And talk about some of the programs that she created that are in question here.
The major one that's being challenged is this ex-offender program in which the Petersburg-Newburgh Association kind of oversaw. And essentially what it is a program that started years ago, and it was meant to employ ex-offenders. Now, what the records started showing in 2009, which is when Louisville Metro Corrections started looking at the program because they're questioning whether it actually was serving a corrections population, was that many people that were attending, actually, there was no ex-offenders attending. The sign-in sheets, which they started requiring, showed that many, often it was Shanklin just on the list, or Shanklin's relatives that were just on this list. Now, in the hearing, her attorney, Aubrey Williams, tried to argue that in the language it just says students of the program, not necessarily ex-offenders. Of course, the whole idea behind the program, though, was that it was for ex-offenders. So that was an interesting finding, just the fact that this program was being spent, you know, thousands of dollars on this program, and it wasn't really serving the population at all.
One big glaring accusation, I guess you would say, is that her she signed a timesheet for her grandson, even though at the time it appears he was incarcerated.
Yeah, and that's one of the five violations that have allegedly been violated by Shanklin, is that she signed Gary Bowler, her ex or her grandson's timesheet while he was incarcerated. During the hearing, Shanklin was called to testify twice. The first day, Tuesday, she walked out at the request of Aubrey Williams, who essentially told her to take the fifth, a broad overall fifth. And in the hearing, what's supposed to happen is that she's supposed to take the fifth on each question that's asked to her. She took a broad fifth, and when they tried to explain the process, Aubrey Williams just told her to get up and go home. And it was a pretty dramatic scene that first day. The second day, which was Wednesday, we weren't expecting to see her back at the stand. Of course, she did take the stand that week, too, and she did answer some questions. One was that she confirmed that, yes, it was her signature on the timesheet, but when they asked, she also confirmed that she didn't know he was incarcerated at the time she signed the timesheet. Then when they tried to redirect questions regarding her discretionary funding, which is behind the whole Petersburg-Newburgh Association, again, Aubrey Williams told her to do exactly what she did the day before and get up and leave, which is what she did again. But she did answer some questions, just not the ones that were posed. And interesting enough, in this hearing, the commission, the seven-member commission, can actually assume adverse responses to any questions posed to Shanklin or Shanklin's empty chair, as it were, in the hearing. So they continued asking the questions after she left, and the commission can basically decide what they want to make out of that.
And you have a piece of tape from the proceedings as well.
Yeah, the Courier-Journal was streaming the whole time for every single second of this thing, and so I have to give them a little props for streaming, because I wasn't able to stay there for 8 hours. so this was basically Aubrey Williams. Part of his major argument was that this was a media frenzy. This was built on the media and not on facts.
This newspaper here would have reported how the drive-by shootings have all but disappeared since she got involved in that community. Newspapers, the media here are not interested in that. Because it does, you know why? Does not sell newspapers. It does not pay for advertising.
Now, of course, there were some good programs that came out of the Petersburg-Newburgh Improvement Association. The ethics hearing isn't about the good programs. It's about a possible alleged violation in one aspect, the ex-offender program. So that was kind of a point maybe that the commission might look at and say, yes, there were good things. And in fact, the prosecutor, Jim Earhart, thank you. He mentioned that. You know, he mentioned that this isn't about the good things, that it's about the violations that she had.
Just a few seconds left, very quickly. When can we expect a decision?
It's gonna take a while, actually. It has to, both sides have to propose additional findings or their views to the hearing officer, Anne Shadell. Anne Shadell gets a month to basically make her own recommendations to the Ethics Commission. Then the Ethics Commission has a month, so that could come by the end of February.
Devin Katayama, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. This is Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Heldet. This week's election has been widely described as a victory for LGBTQ rights. Wisconsin Democrat Tammy Baldwin will become the first openly gay U.S. senator, and several states passed ballot initiatives legalizing same-sex marriage. Jason Gardner and Kyla Story, hosts of WFPL's Strange Fruit podcast, spoke with U of L law professor Sam Markison about the results.
First, let's talk about Tammy Baldwin.
Truly, overall historic, and it's almost impossible to overstate what the overall results mean on so many levels. And in the case of Senator-elect Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, the first person openly elected as openly LGBT to the United States Senate. I think it's fair to infer and assume that we've had gay or lesbian senators before, but they've been in the closet if they've been there. This Tammy Baldwin has been out, totally open, and amazingly and encouragingly, never even an issue in the campaign up there. Her opponent, former Governor Tommy Thompson, never made that an issue. She didn't run on that as a big part of her campaign, her identity as a lesbian. It just faded into the background, which I think is important and historic as a part of the story up there in Wisconsin. And she won a decisive victory in a state that we know is the home of the vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party, a state that had a Republican governor, Scott Walker, who has been sort of at the epicenter of the anti-progressive movement in the last several years. And yet Tammy Baldwin, with an incredibly progressive platform and being openly lesbian, wins that race comfortably against a strong, long-term, well-identified, with great name recognition politician in Wisconsin. And to take that historic step is really pretty incredible and a landmark in American politics for LGBT rights and LGBT identity in our system.
Professor, I'd like for you to speak a bit about marriage equality. So several states this week had measures, ballot initiatives, ballot measures in regards to marriage equality. Maryland approved marriage by a margin of 52-48. It was on the ballot in Minnesota. Talk to me a bit about, you were on a panel a few weeks ago discussing, is the road to marriage equality via the courts, via voters? And the pros and cons maybe from both perspectives.
I think it's got to be both because they affect each other in very important ways. In the elections this week, you saw victories in four different states. In Maine and Maryland, voters approved law, and as well as in Washington State, approved same-sex marriage equality. And in Minnesota, for the first time ever, the voters in the state rejected a constitutional amendment that would bar recognition of same-sex marriage. And that sets the stage now, with Democrats having retaken control of both houses of the Minnesota legislature, and with a Democratic governor, for that state to have its legislature pass, with now that there's no barrier in their constitution, to pass marriage equality. And it seems to me there's a really good argument, I acknowledge, that you don't want civil rights being put to a vote. You don't want people's right to equality, equal treatment, equality under the law being put to the voters, majoritarian preference. But on the other hand, the fact of the matter is anyone's rights ultimately will only be protected if the majority is there willing to fight for them, to protect them. Because even if you win these battles in courts, even if the courts rule in our favor on issues like the Defense of Marriage Act, and even if we win on the Prop 8 case from California, the long-term protection of those rights has to be won because those courts stay willing to protect those rights. And courts will only do that if they're comfortable with where the majority is. And the courts are comfortable with where the majority is if we are winning those battles in the political system as well. So by winning these at the ballot box in a clean sweep in all of these measures, from Maine to Washington, from coast to coast, what that signals to the courts is that there's been a sea change. These had been losing everywhere. And judges get that comfort level. And when judges get that comfort level, they're willing to go out on a limb because they think that limb won't break. And so I'm more than happy now to feel like if the Supreme Court does take those two big cases that are pending on its docket, the Defense of Marriage Act case from Massachusetts and the Prop 8 case from California, that Justice Kennedy, whom everyone thinks would be the swing vote, gets a bigger comfort level thinking that democracy has moved, the people's mood has shifted. And so you get a lot better chance of having your rights enforced when Democratic majorities support those rights. So I'm very comfortable with the effect that this will have in the legal arena as well.
Professor Markerson, can you also speak just briefly around how important legislation and the passing of laws are for actualizing real basic rights for LGBT citizens?
Well, I think that it has a long-term component in terms of being able to get the kind of change by making sure that the people who have the power are willing to exercise the power on our behalf. Let's look at President Obama for a minute. He took enormous risks on behalf of LGBT civil rights in his first term, fighting for repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and winning that fight, refusing to argue for the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, and coming under enormous criticism for that, coming out in favor of equality in marriage. All of those carried enormous political risks for him, for a community that some of the members of which were quite critical of President Obama for not, in their mind, moving fast enough. And they were very suspicious of President Obama at times. Some of the members of our community, the LGBT community, had supported Hillary Clinton during the 2008 primaries and never really warmed to President Obama. So he took some real risks. And this election, his reelection, showed that you can do that and still win the support of the American public, win reelection, and not pay the price at the box office. So if we can win these fights, legislative fights, political fights, and still win elections time after time, that will send a message to mayors, city councils, legislators. There's not such a big price to be paid. You can be the next Tammy Baldwin. You can be the next Barack Obama, whatever your office happens to be. And if that happens, that means we can get more legislation passed. That means we can get more civil rights legislation. We can get equality in marriage. And we can accomplish all sorts of other goals. It opens the door for the next victory as long as we keep winning and politicians realize it's actually safe. You can dip your toe in the water and you won't drown.
Let me ask you about the state of marriage in Kentucky, because in recent years we had a constitutional amendment that banned gay marriage in Kentucky. Do you know much about where we stand? Are there court challenges? Have folks kind of given up that fight? As other states move towards marriage equality, where do Kentuckians stand? What chances do we have towards ever reaching that goal?
Well, things are happening outside of Kentucky that will affect Kentuckians. If, for example, the Proposition 8 case goes to the Supreme Court, depending on how the court decides that case, it could have great impact. If the court decides there is a fundamental federal constitutional right to marriage, and that denying that right to same-sex couples infringes that right, then the state constitutional prohibition here on recognition of marriage would fall by the wayside.
Now, does that happen automatically? So say Prop 8 is overturned, instantly is ours also unconstitutional, or does it face a separate court challenge?
It would depend on the reasoning the court used. If the court used the same reasoning that the Court of Appeals in California used, then it would not affect Kentucky. I don't know if we want to get into the real technicalities of the constitutional reasoning, but the way that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decided that, they said, in brief, they said that only because California had once recognized same-sex marriage and the right was then taken away by Prop 8, that that's what violated the constitutional rights of same-sex couples in California. Since Kentucky has never first recognized it and then took it away, that reasoning wouldn't apply here. But the Supreme Court might decide it on different grounds. Supreme Court might say, we agree with the outcome, but it's because there's a fundamental right to marriage, period, whether it's first granted and taken away or not. And if they decided that, then it would apply in Kentucky, and it would mean that same-sex couples could start marrying in Kentucky, if the court decided it that way. But there's no ongoing campaign right here in Kentucky right now to change or to fight against what's going on with the 2004 marriage amendment in Kentucky, to overturn that, to challenge it, to get the legislature to send it back to the people for a new initiative, etc. It would happen because something is going on outside of Kentucky that might have impact on the state of affairs here in Kentucky.
That was constitutional law professor Sam Markison speaking with Kyla Story and Jason Gardner. To hear the rest of the interview, listen to Strange Fruit this Saturday at WFPL.org. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. Back in August, Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher announced a plan to create a 25-year vision for the city. Vision Louisville will be a year-long project that seeks to define the future of the city. The project will include the Space Group, an internationally renowned architectural and planning firm based in Norway. Here with an update on Vision Louisville are WFPL's Gabe Bullard and Erica Peterson. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Thanks.
Well, Gabe, tell us about the space group. They've recently released some more information about this plan, right?
Yeah, they started out shortly after Mayor Fisher announced that he was commissioning them for this study. They started looking at Louisville's strengths and weaknesses. They eventually put out a report fairly recently of what they found. This is not the 25-year plan per se, but it's the first step in it. They say that they have three steps. They want to imagine the future, initiate a conversation with the public, and then catalog the challenges and actually put that plan together. So this is phase one right now.
So are there any highlights thus far? Are there areas of focus?
Yeah, they released a really big plan. A very large presentation was given to the public, and the city is now gathering some input on that. And the plan, or at least the proposal that they put out there, addresses two global trends that we haven't really seen Louisville take on before. A few other cities are looking at these, though. One of the trends is climate change, and the other is the increasing urbanization of the population as more people around the world are moving to cities.
Yeah, and the plan lays out pretty much what Louisville will look like in 25 years if it continues on its current path. And it's not a very great picture environmentally wise. It includes an additional 50 trillion BTUs, British thermal units, needed to power the city. Three-quarters of Louisville's water systems will be overloaded, and increasingly poor air quality, which would put it among the worst in the U.S., plus a 180% increase in car traffic. And so one of the things the report addresses is the need for more electricity. It suggests more renewable energy. Louisville is in pretty average to good position for things like solar and biomass. It also proposes some projects like turning the Kentucky Expo Center into the first carbon neutral fairground in the country.
And Gabe, this is all built on the assumption that we're going to have a much denser urban area here in Louisville.
Yeah, and there are a few steps in there to fight sprawl or unsustainable sprawl. There's still a recognition, and I think a lot of city planners are looking at this, that people will want to live in the suburbs still, and there are still people who are going to want to live in not as crowded an area. And there are some provisions for that in this report from the space group. But it also emphasizes the importance of having a dense urban area. It plans, for example, reclaiming some of the unused industrial space that the city has. There's something like 12,000 acres that could be turned into housing and cleaned up. There are a lot of vacant lots in certain areas that could be turned into more housing, more efficient housing even, which also plays into some of the environmental friendliness of it by making things a little bit denser, putting more people into that urban space in the city center. But it also proposes, all this that's going to end up improving the regional gross domestic product as well. In looking at cities and building strong cities, the reason for that is that about 40% or more of the state's GDP comes from this area, what they're calling the Beam area around Louisville, Lexington, down to Bowling Green. And so it is predicated on building up that area and making it a place that people want to live in, and making it a place where people can be working, just to make it a more efficient area. It addresses some of the housing problems and just some of the lack of services in the West End. It also calls for creating what they call a library or a city living room on the Museum Plaza site. Seattle did something like this downtown. It's a library in name, and there are books there, but it's also a large public gathering space. And that would start to push some of this urban development a little bit further west.
And Erica, there's a public transportation element to all this as well, right?
Yeah, there is. Right now, about 84% of Louisvillians commute by car. And this plan will aim to get that to about 40% in 25 years. It lays out a light rail network, which is certainly something we've seen proposed before, but never to the point where it seems feasible. It's basically covers all the neighborhoods. It has park and rides at the city's borders. So you could drive in from outside the city park and then go downtown on the light rail. It also aims to connect the busiest workplaces in Louisville, the airport, UPS, Ford, University of Louisville, all the way down to Fort Knox. So that's what that lays out. It also talks about the importance of an extensive network of bike routes and some that are actually separated from the busiest roads so people feel comfortable commuting by bike as well.
Got about 30 seconds left, Gabe. When is all this going to begin?
Sometime over the next year, they're going to be gathering public input. They're going to be finalizing this plan. They hope to have the final plan together within 12 months. And from there, they're going to have to start acting on it.
Vision Louisville, WFPL's Gabe Bullard and Erica Peterson joining us for a recap or an update on Vision Louisville. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
This is Byline on WFPL. Louisville attorney Teddy Gordon is filing a complaint against a Jefferson County School Board member-elect. David Jones Jr. won the board's District 2 seat this week. During the campaign, opponent Phil Hamming questioned whether Jones' prior business experience excludes him from serving on the school board. That complaint has since been picked up by a District 2 resident, represented by Gordon. WFPL's Devin Katayama spoke with Teddy Gordon, who says he's only charging his client a dollar to challenge Jones' seat.
Now, what are the arguments for him not being eligible other than, I mean, he's kind of addressed and he says he's done his homework with areas of the law and how he might pose conflicts of interest with his prior businesses. But what do you see?
Well, first of all, he brought it up as an issue, which is one of the problems. He said he would recuse himself from any vote on a conflict of interest.
Now, on the point of him bringing it up, he was responding to Phil Hamming's accusations of similar nature and saying that he would recuse himself from any board decision. So I think that's important to note, too.
Yes, if he says he'll recuse himself, then there's an admission that there's a conflict of interest, and that's what the statute says you can't have, and therefore you're ineligible. I've reviewed the law. To me, there's three areas, maybe more, that he has conflicts of interest. And one is his power position with Humana that clearly does business with health insurance that covers all the Jefferson County Public School employees. He's a major shareholder, and he has a pecuniary interest as to Humana getting the business.
Now, on the point of Humana, the state organized those contracts, right? It wasn't a school board decision, so that's why, I mean, that was his point, was that the Humana contracts weren't even done by the school board.
Except they have health insurance on all 10,000 employees, and there's a pecuniary and proprietary interest that he has as a major shareholder and being on the board of Humana. So if that's enough to disconnect a conflict of interest because the statute says direct or indirect, to me it's more than enough. All he has to do, like others, and it's very magnanimous that he runs for office and, of course, has now won, because I have the utmost respect for the Jones family, is like anybody else who's in that position where they have lots of wealth, is that they put their holdings in a blind trust and they step aside as a board director from any company that would have a conflict. And he would be in the same company as George Bush Sr. and Jr., not too bad a company to be in. If Mitt Romney would have prevailed, he would have been in the same company as Mitt Romney, who would have put all of his holdings in a blind trust. We ask no more from David Jones Jr., and we hope he does.
In this election, nearly half supported some sort of neighborhood schools choice, but none of the candidates that were supporting neighborhood schools won a seat. How does that play into the work that you've been doing the past several years to invalidate the JCPS student assignment plan?
District 7, if you add the total number of votes that were divided among Sexton and Robertson and Fell, they would be a greater number than Brady. And this community, we just got our tax bills. This is the second point. So I don't think it's a clear band-aid for the student assignment plan. It's a clear mandate that we see what happens with 13 clusters and see if educational outcome improves. So I think the jury is way, way out and still decide if this community wants to continue to tolerate an 80% failure rate for $100 million of our tax dollars.
Mr. Gordon, thank you, as always, for taking the time to speak with me.
All right, thank you.
Louisville attorney Teddy Gordon speaking with WFPL's Devin Katayama. This is Byline on WFPL. Well, it's been nearly 2 weeks now since a Paducah and Louisville railway train carrying hazardous chemicals derailed near the West Point community in southwestern Jefferson County. That incident and a subsequent fire, as workers were attempting to clean up the scene, prompted several days of evacuations and shelter-in-place orders, which have now been lifted. And here with an update on it is WFPL's Joseph Lord. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Rick.
Welcome back. Thanks. Well, the evacuations were lifted. Dixie Highway is at least partially open to traffic.
Right.
But has the derailment actually been cleared yet?
No. The cars are still there, and over the past weekend, crews were able to stabilize the car that was giving them the most concern, two cars that were carrying the chemical hydrogen fluoride. They were stabilized and leveled, but the hydrogen fluoride is still in the cars. So the latest is that today, P&L and the contractor who's working on the cleanup were to submit a plan where they were to basically say how they were going to get that stuff out of there.
And P&L has opened an assistance center, I guess, for residents who've been affected by this?
Yes. There's a compensation center. They're reimbursing people for hotel rooms, businesses that may have lost business because of the evacuations. People were just showing up to these centers. Now they're doing it by appointment. There are several phone numbers people can call. We have the information on our website. If you search P&L Railway, you can find that.
While we have you here, you've also been covering the story. There was a report that came out yesterday from the Kentucky Justice Cabinet on constables, the old constitutional office in Kentucky, that pretty much, just to in a nutshell, was calling for the abolition of the position.
Right. Constables are, for people who may not be aware of what constables are, they're elected officials in the state. They have law enforcement powers, which means they can write you a ticket, they can make an arrest, but they're not required to have any training. They're not required to have any qualifications to take these offices. Once they're elected, they have law enforcement powers. There have been some incidents. There was one in Louisville last year where there was a constable who got into a bit of a trouble. So therefore, the state justice cabinet looked into this issue, and now they're saying that either the office should be abolished, which would have to happen through a constitutional amendment, which is difficult to do, or the state should look to ways to roll back their powers.
Got about 30 seconds left. You also talked to the head of the Constables Association, who says, well, man, not so fast. I mean, some of these guys, men and women, are doing significant work.
Right. There are constables, particularly in rural areas where there isn't a lot of law enforcement, where they do some law enforcement work. But the state says that constables do a fraction of a percent of actual law enforcement in the state. So you can sort of see it both ways.
All right, Joseph Lord, thanks for joining us. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Hallett. What is time for our arts segment, and WFPL's Aaron Keene is here with us. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having us.
You have a couple of special guests with you, but before we do that, I want to go over a couple of things going on this weekend. First of all, the Slant Culture Theater Festival underway. What's going on there?
Yeah, it opened last night with a big launch party, and we have tonight there are shows, and then there's a full weekend of events. Now, the festival actually goes through next week as well, but the weekends are kind of fun because programming starts in the early afternoon and goes all the way to late night. So there are 5 plays that are happening at this festival, but there's also things like workshops with Art FM Radio, Squalus Puppeteers, food trucks, musicians, a bar at Walden Theater, which is something you don't see every day. So something for everyone, as they say.
Sounds like a lot of fun. And also a new play about Frida Kahlo premiering at Bellarmine tonight.
Yeah, yeah. Bellarmine University's theater professor, Carlos Chavarria, wrote a new play about Frida Kahlo and did some intensive research in Mexico City, researching her life, hanging out at her house, which is now a museum. One cool thing that I learned about this play is that all of the costumes and props, about 90% of them are also sourced from Mexico, from markets where indigenous people sort of sell their handiwork, that sort of thing. So Carlos really went the extra mile to get the authentic touch. It opens tonight at Bellarmine and runs through next week.
And Carlos, I think, pointed out that this is about Frida. It's not about her husband, who was fairly famous, right?
Yes, yes. Frida Kahlo was married to Diego Rivera, and he said one thing that really frustrated him when he was reading other plays and deciding what he wanted to stage was that all of the work written about Frida Kahlo seems to put her work and her life in, like, basically in the perspective of, and she was married to this womanizing painter, and that is really, that's her story, right? And he really wanted the story to be about her. So, yeah, she's married to him, and yes, you know, that factors into her life, but it's not that's not how she's defined, which I thought was a really cool approach.
And finally, the Spalding University Festival of Contemporary Writing opens tomorrow.
Yeah, this is a six-day festival reading series that coincides with Spalding's low residency MFA program. So all of the faculty and students who work within this graduate creative writing program are in town twice a year. So this and the faculty and special guests give public readings, and they're all open to the public. And most of them happen either at Spalding or at the Brown Hotel. Kicks off tomorrow afternoon, and some of the more maybe notable readings that are happening this week. Diane April, who I think a lot of Louisville folks know, she's on faculty. She's back in town, and she'll be reading from her new book on the Parklands of Floyd's Fork on Sunday. Also, Fenton Johnson is in town on Tuesday reading from Keeping Faith, A Skeptic's Journey Among Christians and Buddhist Monks. And Crystal Wilkinson and Molly Peacock will be reading on Wednesday. So there's really a full weeks of great free literature out there.
Very good. And now we turn to Actors Theater. Can you introduce us to your guests?
Yes. I'm here with Amy Attaway, the Associate Artistic Director of Actors Theater's Apprentice Intern Program. Say hi, Amy.
Hey, Erin.
And Noelia Atweiler, who is an acting apprentice.
Hello.
And Noelia, this is actually, we're here to talk about your program, actually. Yeah. Noelia is an apprentice, but she brought this amazing playwriting program to the Actors Theater Company, and it's called Voices Inside, a Prison Play Series. It's a monthly event where the Actors Theater apprentices perform staged readings of 10-minute plays that are written by playwrights who are incarcerated and who work in this program that you've taught in. So tell us a little bit about this program.
So I started with the Voices Inside program in the summer of 2011. I got a job acting with the Pioneer Playhouse, which is in Danville, Kentucky, about 2 hours south of here. And they have an outreach program called Voices Inside, which teaches playwriting and acting to prisoners incarcerated at the North Point Training Center, which is the medium security prison in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And it's a course that teaches, as I said, playwriting and acting to inmates. So I started with that program in summer of 2011 and taught 10 inmates 4 times a week from June through August, and then went away and completed my last year at school, and then auditioned for the acting apprentice program and got in and was lucky enough to come here. And I thought, well, I'm very close, so why don't I see if we can have these works by these men read by professional actors at Actors Theater.
And so, Amy, that's where you come in.
That's right. So, as you know, the Apprentice Intern Company at Actors is a group of the 43 best and brightest young theater makers from around the country, and they come and spend 9 months with us at Actors learning the ropes of professional theater. They support all of the main stage work that we do at Actors, and we also produce a full season of plays that are just for them. And in addition to that, we offer all the apprentices and interns the opportunity to do what we call independent projects, which basically means that any of them can come to us and say, I've got this idea. Can we do it?
Wow.
And we almost always say, yes, let's do it. So Noelia brought this idea to us at the very beginning of the season to do some staged readings of these plays. And we thought, what a great way for the apprentices to learn about staged readings, to learn about working on new plays, and to reach out to the Louisville community in a really unique way.
So, okay, for folks listening, how does a staged reading differentiate from a production of a play?
So in a staged reading, the actors are reading from the script of the play, usually at music stands, usually on an intimate stage, right? So the actors are standing there, and they're acting. They're in character. They're looking at each other. They're interacting with each other. But they're not off book, they're not memorized, and there's someone usually reading the stage directions so that the audience can experience what would be happening if we were staging the full production. So it's a really intimate and interesting way to experience a play because it becomes all about the words and all about the people.
And so what role does a stage reading play in the life of a production? Why would that be an interesting addition or a component to a play's the life of a play script?
It's often the very first time that the playwright hears their words come to life, right? And so usually in a regular process of a new play, the playwright can hear the words and then go back and do some rewrites and figure out what they need to do to get it really on its feet. Mm-hmm. For this project, it's maybe the only time that these writers are going to get to hear their words out loud, performed by professional actors. We, of course, can't bring the writers to hear the performances, and so we've been recording them.
Oh, wow. Yes. I was going to ask that, yeah.
So, yeah, we have been recording all the productions, and we've given the DVDs to the warden at North mm-hmm. Point, and they've set up I don't think it's happened yet, but they've set up a specific time for all the guys to come in and sit and watch.
Wow.
Watch the performance and then the talk back afterwards about the program.
So, Noelia, what is that like going into even a medium security prison, but going into a prison as a college student and teaching playwriting to incarcerated men?
The first time it was really scary. You know, a medium security prison the differentiation between levels of prisons really doesn't have anything to do with the crime they committed. It's more about behavior. So mm-hmm. I am working with murderers and rapists and, you know, people down to petty theft, you know, but a wide array of crimes. So the first time I went in, it was like intimidating and scary. And I thought these men would be sort of mean and cruel and scary and rude and all that sort of negative stuff. But actually, I find them to be compelling and intelligent and very respectful. And they always make me feel safe. And their words are good. They're very good writers, especially considering that all except for one of them have had no experience with theater prior to this program.
And so what are some of the plays been about that you guys have read so far?
We encourage them to write from the heart and to write what they know. So the first drafts of plays were sort of about bunnies and rainbows and, you know, like very light subjects. But mostly they write about prison and prison life or the crimes that got them into prison. So we had a crime about domestic abuse. We had a play about, you know, a relationship with a guard or a relationship with a parole officer or what life in the yard is like. This month we have a racial play about a white guy and a black guy in prison and sort of that dynamic. Another play about domestic abuse this month. And yeah.
And so, Amy, you read a lot of new plays every year.
I do.
How do these plays differ from the plays that you're reading from professional and aspiring playwrights who have been out there going through their MFA programs and hustling in theaters and producing work?
Well, as you can imagine, they're a lot less polished, right? Mm-hmm. And they have a lot less of that sort of MFA panache to them, that sort of artsy, impossible stage direction sort of, you know what I'm talking about, the highfalutin things that a lot of young writers are doing today.
Stuart fades until he disappears.
Exactly.
But he's still on stage.
The elevator opens and water pours out, yes. For example. So, but what I've found so compelling about these plays is that they're so truthful. You know, there's no pretense to these plays at all. The one that I found the most moving was where it was clear that the writer had put himself in the shoes of his victim. Mm. It was written from the woman's point of view and was really her story. And I found that so moving to think that this man who's been locked up for whatever abuse he did to this woman was able to put himself in her shoes and tell us her story in such a really beautiful and truthful way.
Wow. Wow. And so what... So. I mean, the benefits for the playwrights sound evident. What are the benefits for the acting apprentices, Amy? Why is this a good thing for them to be doing once a month on a Monday night?
I think it's actually related to what we were just saying, you know, because they read a lot of plays too. Mm-hmm. You know, they read a lot of plays out there in the world, a lot of plays that are unpublished, a lot of plays that are published. But this sort of immediate and visceral connection with the community and with people who are people mm-hmm. and not necessarily theater people, you know.
There's a difference.
no comment. But you know what I mean? To be able to sort of poke your head outside our arts bubble that we live in 24 hours a day and see what the rest of the world is up to is really, really valuable.
And so are you acting in these plays as well, Noelia?
I have not been acting. Okay. I think it's important. I act with them once a week when I go down to North Point to teach. So I usually read stage directions, and I sort of manage the whole thing. But the other apprentices are the actors and directors and stage managers.
And so these are open to the public. These performances are, and they happen once a month on Monday evenings. And the next one is... this coming Monday, yes?
That's right. Yes. And we're moving locations this time, which I'm very excited about. We're moving over to the Rudyard Kipling, which is one of my very favorite places in Louisville to see performances. So It's free. All we ask is that you patronize the Rudd and purchase some beverages. Come and hear the plays for free. And it starts at 8 o'clock at the Rudyard Kipling this Monday. And then December 10th is the next one.
So is that usually, what is that, the second Monday of the month? Is there a regular rotation like that, or does it move?
The apprentice's schedule is so crazy. Mm-hmm. It's the Monday that they're free.
Yeah, and folks should know, I mean, the apprentices, and those of you who listen to The Big Break and hear Samantha's stories know that the apprentices are acting, and they're also on crew for productions, and they're in workshops, and they are busy, busy, busy. So for them to take, Mondays are days off at the theater, so they're taking their day off and doing these productions that the community's invited to, and that's really a wonderful thing. There's a full schedule on actorstheater.org, yes?
December is the last one we have planned so far. So this coming Monday and December 10th.
Wow. So, get it while it's hot.
All right, Amy, Noelia, thanks for joining us. Great work. Erin Keene, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Rick.
That's all the time we have for today's program. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.